Hi, welcome to Public Health Nutrition from Foodies in the Field, a podcast showcasing stories from passionate foodies about who they are and what they do. I'm Sophie Wright-Pedersen, your podcast host, and on today's show we have Amy Kirad, who is a passionate public health researcher. Amy is also a massive advocate for volunteering and spends a lot of her time volunteering in healthy eating and physical activity programs in her local community. Amy comes from a public health background and has moved into the area of food within that space. She completed a PhD in 2019 and has since been employed as a research assistant through the University of Wollongong on two larger projects. Firstly, a systematic literature review for the World Health Organization, which looked at nutrition labelling policy, and the second one, and more recent one, which is what we're going to be talking about in today's episode, is a project exploring food system governance at the local level. So Amy talks all about the process of how they did this, what they found, and how people can work with local governments in policy development, policy advocacy, and how we as a profession might be able to support local governments and organisations working at that local level in the food governance space. Hi Amy, welcome to the show.
Hey Sophie, thanks for having me on.
That's a pleasure. Tell me more about the Australian Local Food System Policy Database. What is it? What is it trying to achieve? And how did the idea of it all come about?
So the database, I guess, is one part of the project. It's an output of the project. So when I say the project, we're talking about strengthening food system governance at the local level. So when we're talking about food systems, we're talking about the web of people, processes, inputs and outputs that go into growing, processing and distributing, consuming and disposing of food. So it's that whole spectrum from start to finish. We're also looking at the governance aspects. And so in really simple terms, those are kind of the rules and the structures that we put in place around a certain thing and how we organize ourselves in society. So we're looking at how food systems, so that whole cycle from start to finish, what are the rules, you know, policies and structures that are in place that govern and determine the direction that we take in our food systems?
Yeah, okay. And why was the focus on that particularly?
Because policy determines a lot of things. My supervisor, so Dr. Belinda Reeve from the Sydney University Law School, she recognised that there's a lot more research on food system governance at state and the federal government level in Australia, but there's not really much at what we're calling the local level. And so talking about local governments, but also what we call civil society organizations. So you kind of like your not-for-profits, your non-government organizations, community coalitions, and that sort of thing. We don't really know a lot about how they contribute to those formal structures.
Yeah. And when you're talking local government, you're talking like local council.
Yeah. That lowest tier of government in Australia. So yeah, what we would call councils. Yeah. And so Belinda had that hypothesis that maybe local governments were doing a lot more than we think they are in the food space. Mm. And we can kind of say now that we've done the research, we can say that, yeah, that's correct. And they really do quite a lot. And it's really varied and oftentimes obviously like reflects their local context.
For this project, it's you and then Belinda as well. Who else is on the team that you've been working with?
Yeah, so Belinda Reeve from Sydney University Law School is the what we call the chief investigator. So she applied for the grant and was successful. And so that grant proposal was also put forth with the support of Karen Charlton from the University of Wollongong and Nick Rose from the William Anglis Institute of TAFE down in Melbourne. And Nick's also the executive director of Sustain at the Australian Food Network.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so they're kind of the lead investigators and the people that have had a lot of experience in this space for a long time. And so they employed me as one of the research assistants. And I also worked alongside, at the beginning, Ekerne Aguirre-Belchowski. And then we also had Lizzie Turner working with us for a short time and the honors student Rebecca Smith.
It's so interesting to hear like who's on the project, because I think for a project like this, which is very, you know, it is very systematic and it spans a lot of different areas, it takes a team of people who are very
diverse and have diverse levels of expertise. And so then how did you go about actually doing that process, and what were you focusing on when you were doing that?
So the process was this policy mapping study exercise that we did for all of the local governments in New South Wales and Victoria. So that's 207 councils in total.
Oh my God.
We were looking at every single local government's website, and Kone was such a wonder to work with. So she had all the Victorian councils and I had all the New South Wales ones. And prior to me starting the project team had developed what we call this framework of recommended actions for local government. So what can local governments potentially be doing in the food system space? And the framework has 34 recommendations. These are grouped into 8 domains. So we've got having a food system policy, and then number 2, health and well-being, sustainability and environment, economic development, food waste, food safety and hygiene, affordable housing and planning frameworks.
Interesting. So it's quite holistic then.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the ways this project was innovative and new was A, the scope of it, that we were looking at so many local governments in Australia's 2 most populous states, but also that it's one of the first pieces to really look at that whole food system. So research that's being done has often maybe focused on, you know, urban planning and the, you know, where a supermarket's located, or it might have really focused on particularly just the food and the diet related health outcomes of food, but no one had really looked at what local governments are doing across the whole spectrum, which is what made it really big.
Yeah. And when you're talking about that framework and, you know, all the components that are in there, where did that come from, or how was it decided that those components should be part of that framework?
Yeah. So the project team did a literature review, so particularly including Australian research literature and also international grey literature, so reports and also frameworks that exist at a global scale, things such as the Milan Urban Food Policy Pact, and kind of brought together all of the components that were mentioned in there and then tailored it to make sure that it was relevant to the Australian jurisdiction, because there might be some things that happen overseas that Australian local governments have absolutely no authority over.
You then took that framework and then looked at these 200 and something odd councils and mapped their policies against that framework.
Yeah, that's right. So Akona and I had set up the system. So you look at a local government's website, and we had to find all their policies and their strategic guiding documents. New South Wales and Victoria have particular documents that they have to create, like a community strategic plan and council plan in Victoria. And so for every council, we had a kind of what we called a core set, so that there was some documents that we knew that we had to get from every local government. And then other than that, it was any policy that might have had something to do with any of those 34 recommendations from our framework, which took a lot of working out to know which policies would ever potentially be relevant and which would have no relevance, even if they had titles that might have led you to think that they were.
Yeah, okay. So what were the ones that you thought would have had stuff in them but they didn't?
So it was really typical for, particularly for New South Wales local governments, to have a procurement policy. Basically none of them had anything to do with food, but they have scope to. So this is what we're saying, like you've got a procurement policy that includes preferred suppliers for particular services or products, and that's actually a really good avenue to get them to include food in that, so that you'd have preferred, you know, ethical and healthy food suppliers as part of your food procurement. And local governments that had an equivalent, then they'd have a separate document that was something like a healthy catering policy, and they'd have it was entirely separate. They didn't see it as procurement. So in the end, we had 2,266 documents that are included in our final data set, which is, yeah, absolutely huge. So it took us about 18 months to do all of that. So searching the websites, downloading documents, and then analysing them against the framework. And then I guess from that, as we said, you know, this was exploratory. We were trying to work out who was doing what and what was the most common. So that kind of formed the primary output of our analysis, was running statistics to see which areas in the framework were the most commonly acted upon, which were the framework actions that governments were least involved in, and also to see if there were any differences between the two states and also between metropolitan councils, so those kind of more urban inner city ones, and then regional and rural councils.
And what were the, I guess, some of the bigger outcomes of you running those statistics and looking at the numbers?
So really interestingly for us, you've got 79 councils in Victoria, and 11 of them had what we kind of call a dedicated food system policy. So this is a document that shows that breadth across the whole food system, and it's bringing all of those components together into one cohesive document. It'll often have actions that are allocated to various departments, and they're all kind of working together. So you've got fewer councils in Victoria, but a lot of them had them. Whereas, yeah, New South Wales, you've got 128 local governments, but only two had an equivalent. So we've got a lot more action in Victoria, and we kind of found that across the board. So that was for the dedicated food system policy, but across the framework, there were 29 of the 34 recommendations. Victorian local governments were more likely to have a policy document or something in a policy document that addressed that recommendation.
And is there any reason for that? Like, what is it about Victoria that you think they've incorporated this more than maybe New South Wales has?
So we can't say whether it's 100% causal because we weren't looking at those mechanisms, but, you know, we've got the knowledge of particular programs and also legislative frameworks that might have produced that. So Victoria's got a longer history, particularly of working in diet-related health. They've got the Vic Health, so their Health Promotion Foundation, which for a really long time has been funded to encourage efforts to improve diet and diet health through diet, which has potentially got that trickle-on effect to having more of the local governments involved in food system. And also there's a Public Health Act in Victoria that requires that every single local government develops a municipal public health and wellbeing plan.
Yeah, okay.
And so within that, again, it's really encouraged a lot of them to address healthy eating. And it is only specific to healthy eating more so, but it's given some of the local governments a platform for them to leverage their municipal public health and wellbeing plans and draw on the passion of some staff to start to integrate food systems more broadly.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And so New South Wales, I'm assuming, doesn't have anything like that.
That's correct. So we do not. The closest legislative thing that we have in New South Wales is the Food Act, but that only legislates local governments to be concerned around food safety and hygiene in retail businesses.
Yeah, okay. And did you find that when you were mapping out local government policy areas, was New South Wales hitting the mark on that area, like hygiene and food safety?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was the highest ranked area in the framework. So, you know, presumably all the local governments are doing something. Our statistic was something like 96.6%, which would have just meant that we didn't actually find a document on their website that says that they do something.
Yeah, for that 4%. And so when you're talking about like the Food Act and the Public Health Act in Victoria, they're state-based policies and legislation, aren't they?
Exactly. So they are, yeah, state-enacted policy, and the responsibilities for that passed down onto local governments.
What are you kind of advocating for or like thinking about from mapping out all this stuff and all the findings that you've got?
It involves recommendations that we can put forward in terms of legislative and policy change. So as you pointed out, you know, Victoria's got those state level legislations that require them to do certain things that have prompted action towards food systems. So we can recommend that New South Wales adopts a similar legislation in terms of public health, and that it specifically requires local governments to address food related outcomes. And that we could see that you can see that it's been effective for food safety. They've said you have to do it, and all the local governments have a policy in place and presumably are enacting that policy on the ground because there's a lot of accountability mechanisms.
Yeah, interesting. So that's one of the bigger things, is advocating for state level policies to then influence local level government
Yeah, and this is really confirmed after we did this policy mapping. We did also send a survey out to all of those local governments as well. So it was to say, is there anything that you haven't got on your website that we've missed, or tell us about what you're doing? We had a relatively small response rate. There was only about 64 councils that responded across both states. But it did also allow us to start exploring. We had some questions around the barriers and the enablers that they face in doing that work. And so then we did a deeper dive into policy development and implementation and barriers and enablers by doing case study interviews with six local governments. So we had three in each of the states. And again, I think that really helped us form those ideas around, well, yes, this is what local governments are doing, but these are the things that are stopping them from doing more and having the power to do what they want and act in the interest of their community. So that really helped us to form some further recommendations that we wouldn't have gotten from the policy mapping alone.
Definitely. And what were some of those big like enablers or barriers for those local government employees?
A lot of time funding.
Yeah.
Funding is always a thing. So local government is at the lowest tier in our federal government system. They are the least resourced, the least funded, and they have the least opportunities to generate revenue themselves to then put into programs that they want. And there's also no funding for what I would call food systems work. So there might be funding for a really short-term project related to, say, food waste. But these are really short-term, means that councils have to live grant to grant, and it's on a topic base. So there's no funding for them to strategically do work across the whole food system. And essentially the projects that are funded, the outcomes are really kind of identified by those funders. You know, say, we want food waste, we want you to have, you know, you can fund community gardens, but there's no one that's just paying local governments to do the core work that is involved in needs assessments of their community and paying staff to be able to have more than a 12-month contract.
I think that's really interesting because I've worked in that grant space and applied for grants, and you are really just trying to shape your program to the funding body's priorities when there's a need that you've already identified and a way to respond to that because you've spoken to the community, but you can't actually do that because you don't just have this funding that you can just spend on whatever it is that you need to do. Do you think that if local governments were given, I guess, funding to just be able to do a needs assessment and then respond accordingly, depending on what the needs are for that food system work, is that something that would work better than the current way that it's working?
I mean, from our public health backgrounds, we know that, yeah, that's the best way to do something. So I guess we're putting forward this case now because of the project saying that, yes, we'd love New South Wales to have an equivalent public health act that mandates that local governments have a health and wellbeing plan, that they involve food and nutrition, but also things around climate change and the effects of that. But we can't say do that because you can't mandate it and give local governments no more resources to do it with. You're just giving them more work without any more capacity. So state governments also need to be funding food systems work. And food systems work doesn't start once you start, I don't know, building community gardens or putting a project on the ground. It starts from that community consultation and the needs assessment. And there's some really great examples, particularly in Victoria, so Bendigo and Cardinia, really holistically engage with their community, and particularly Bendigo in the formation of their food system strategy. They put a lot longer than they might normally into consulting community and getting hard-to-reach groups like farmers that are obviously integral but often don't engage with those consultation processes because they're busy on the farm. And so this is what I mean about food systems work. Like, it's funding that so that you have then developed a policy or a strategy that reflects your local community. It has resourcing to then implement the action plan of the strategy and has the capacity to evaluate properly. So evaluating at the start, evaluating throughout, but also being able to monitor further down the line what impact that's having on tangible outcomes like attendance at workshops, but also those longer term things that are really hard to capture and that you can never potentially pin down to having a food system strategy, like actual health outcome change and having reduced rates of disease.
So with those two examples, like Bendigo and Cardinia, have they got like dedicated funding for enacting and implementing policy?
Yeah, so those two are unique in the respect that they both have staff that are titles kind of like a food systems officer. So they, different ways of funding them, they have a dedicated person in their local government whose responsibility it is to ensure that their food system strategies are implemented. Whereas the other local governments that have dedicated food system policies don't have a dedicated position. So it means that responsibility for implementing the strategy falls into multiple departments who might not talk to each other, have no idea what each other are doing, and you have no accountability to that implementation. And of course, Cardinia and Bendigo, they have that person, but that person's job isn't to do everything. It's to facilitate everyone and make sure that everyone's talking to everyone else.
And I think that's so important. Like, I'm just thinking while you're talking, both from like my experience of working, but also from other people I've talked to, both like in my general professional life, but even on this podcast, where a lot of people have said, we just need a dedicated person because it is a lot of that coordination work. And at multiple levels, like you're talking local government, but, you know, even at a state government level, because it is always quite siloed, like the food system, it's spread out through so many different disciplines. Like you've got housing in there, which I don't think a lot of people would think about when we talk about food system. And it's so nice to see that there's like an example where it's actually worked in real life and you can see the outcomes of someone actually having a dedicated role and funding to coordinate that space and how much more effective that can be.
Yeah, absolutely. Whereas when you've got that siloed approach, there's never cohesion, or there might even be duplication, unnecessary duplication of activities from local governments, which is obviously a waste of resources and everything.
Were there any other like facilitators or barriers when you were talking with government employees about what helped to do policy development and implementation in this space?
Enablers were things like consultation and having the ability to really genuinely consult their community. And I know on your previous podcast with Burble, she mentioned this one, and it's a really common one, and it's also a kind of a big ticket issue in the sense that it would require one change that would give local governments a lot more power, and that's around planning frameworks. And local governments really expressed that even if they want to, they are so constrained because of the state planning schemes. They're really constrained about where they can have certain food businesses in their local government area. So the way it works at the moment is that a local government will have approvals for a particular area to be zoned as, say, residential, or it might be zoned as commercial, retail. And within that, they don't have the power to say, but there must be a fresh fruit and veg produce stall in here, and there cannot be a fast food outlet. They don't have that. So even if you've got community opposition to another fast food outlet coming in, local government can do nothing. And then they're up against very, very wealthy chains and corporations in terms of big food with very little money. They oftentimes don't bother fighting, because then they'd end up going to court and tribunals and spending a lot of money knowing that they're going to lose anyway.
And does anyone, like when you're talking about, you mentioned state level, like does anyone have the power to govern that, or is it just non-existent? There's no way that that can be governed currently.
Not completely sure about a direct answer to that. But one of our proposals recommendations coming out of the project is that the state planning schemes could be changed to say this scheme now gives local government power to determine planning and retail mix with consideration of the health and well-being priorities of their communities.
Interesting.
Something along those lines would give local governments to then obviously do that, and they can go, well, you know, the 10th fast food restaurant in this 1 kilometre radius does not do anything for the health and well-being interests of our community. Therefore, no, you cannot build here.
I'm very interested to see how that would play out. I think if you spoke to like some lawyers who were very well versed in this type of policy construction, how that would play out, because I did a mapping exercise when I was in Alice Springs about food mapping. I think Cardinia's actually maybe done something similar where we mapped the stores around town, and I was like, oh yeah, it'll be really easy. We'll just map the healthy stores and the unhealthy stores. And then actually defining what was healthy and unhealthy became quite difficult. Like, there's the obvious ones, like, you know, fresh fruit and veg was really healthy. And then you have, yeah, your fast food outlets. So you're like, okay, that's unhealthy. But then you've kind of got these in-betweens. So, like, you know, your typical supermarkets will sell obviously healthy food, but they also have unhealthy food. And then what about your corner stores or like your convenience stores that are maybe like a petrol station outlet that might sell some healthy stuff, but predominantly they're probably selling like lots of chocolate bars and chips and soft drinks. Yeah. And so, and I think what you're saying is really important. Like, I would love to see something like that, but I'm really intrigued to see how we would actually define what is healthy and what is unhealthy, or is that up to the determination of the local council community? Have you thought about that at all? Or
no, I guess we haven't thought in that level of detail, and you're right, like, that it's a huge thought process. But the good news is that Australia is really behind a lot of other places in the world in relation to food systems and their governance. And so we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We can look to other places and see what they've done. Obviously need to adapt that to local circumstances, but we're not that innovative in this space. And so there's a lot of work we can be doing that can be modelled on what has been implemented, and if there's, you know, successful examples from elsewhere. But just to wrap up our chat about that first bit with the local government, so some, I guess, the major output from this was the development of a database that contains the sections of the policy that we analyse that are included in our statistics. So it's kind of a presentable version of a very messy back end of a program that you use. It's commonly used when you do qualitative data analysis. So it's really exciting because now anyone in the world can go onto our website, and through there, there's a database that contains the bits from all of the policies. So it doesn't contain the whole policy, but it contains the bits from the whole, from the policies that related to the framework. So instead of people spending 18 months having to look around and go, oh, like we did, what a local government's doing, they can now go on there at the click of the button. You can search for a variety of topics. You can filter it by the local government name or by the state or by it being metropolitan or regional. It's demonstrated that local governments are doing a lot. And it's now this resource that is hopefully particularly useful to other local governments. So they can go, well, we're interested in doing more. What can we do? What have others done? And they can now jump on there really easily and look at that. So it was a really exciting, big outcome from the project. So then I guess there were two other really good things that came out of our policy mapping. So the first one was a lot more recent, and it was obviously the ability to really use these findings to hopefully, yeah, maybe inform policy. So there was a New South Wales parliamentary inquiry into food production and supply that was calling for submissions of evidence and recommendations. So we were able to kind of bring together the findings around local government that we'd had from our project and put forward the evidence and also some recommendations. So really tangible use of the findings to be able to put to someone that will hope, you know, these decision makers that will hopefully listen to it. And we might actually see discussion around those proposals around having legislative reform that would give more power to local governments and more resources to them.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And then my last little absolute highlight, I think, from this project maybe was that in November last year, we were planning to hold a workshop to present the findings of the local government component, and then had some discussion rooms where we had smaller group discussions in breakout rooms, and this was all online because of the pandemic. And based on a similar-ish event, Belinda and I were saying, oh, it'd be nice if we got 70 people. And then I think it was within maybe even 48 hours, we had over 200 registrations. Yeah, we went into panic mode trying to find more people to help us facilitate breakout rooms. We ended up with over 300 registrations, and obviously not everyone attended on the day. But to me, it's still like a very early career it was so cool to know that people were interested in what I had spent 18 months with my head in this thousands of policy documents. To know that people are interested in that was so cool.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. And it really shows, like you said at the start, like just how much people don't really know about what's happening in this space, because they've probably never come across something like this before. If, you know, they're jumping on board, it obviously was such a worthwhile project. And so what did you do in that workshop and who came along?
Again, it was super cool that we've been doing this work looking at local governments, and we obviously had a lot of local government staff register and attend, but it was also, you know, researchers like ourselves and academics that are also looking at food systems topics. Councillors, as in the people that we elect to represent us at local government level. And that's really important because they're the ones that get things across the line. They're the ones that are in council meetings and they vote on issues. And so council staff are important, but councillors really hold a lot of power in helping reflect community interests and needs up into proposals at local government level. Yeah, so it was this real big mix, and there was people, I think, from almost all the states and territories. I think it was maybe Northern Territory was the one that we didn't have. I know that's close to your heart. So that was also really great that, you know, we were focused on those on New South Wales and Victoria, but people from around Australia were also really interested in that. Yeah, what the workshop was, and it again, the recording of it and a report from it are available through our website. So I was presenting the results of the policy mapping, and then my other colleague, Lizzie, did a presentation, and then we split the people that were still on the call into smaller groups and kind of just asked them similar questions to what the interviews with the case studies had asked. So, you know, what is happening in your area? What are the enablers? What are the barriers? And also, I guess it's kind of this wish list, like what do local governments need to help them do more or to do better in this space? The summary of those discussion groups is available as a report through our website.
Yeah, and did they reflect, I guess, what we talked about before, like more funding and having more policy at a state level, or was there anything different that those groups of people brought to the table?
Not really, which is also a nice feeling. One of the issues that came up in all of these things was also whose responsibility is food and food systems. And so we've got this lack of leadership at a federal level, which trickles down to not having a cohesive approach at state level, and then, of course, local government level as well, and also those levels of governments not interacting on this. And so it's all really patchy.
When you say lack of leadership and, like, no dedicated role, are you talking about within the government or, like, generally speaking, and who do you think should have that role?
Yeah, so federal government-wise, I mean, at the federal level, we've got the Department of Agriculture and this framing that, I mean, we've seen it during the pandemic. We've seen the messages of where don't worry about your food security, it's fine. But people are worried about food security, and we export a lot of what we grow, and we've got this huge agriculture and export focus at a federal level. But we're not thinking food systems at that level. We've got things coming out now like the National Obesity Strategy. And I guess in my circles, and I would really love to see it as well, I think there really needs to be that higher level leadership from federal, which would trickle down to state, in terms of them having dedicated food system strategies and policies. And it needs to work across all the levels. So it needs to be federal, state, local government, but it also then needs to include community. So we need that top-down leadership in terms of, okay, this is how we're going to address food systems strategically in Australia, but then that needs to be informed by the bottom up from the grassroots and the people that experience food issues on the ground.
Do you see those policies sitting in a particular government department, or what's the mechanism there for that?
I know that other people have really kind of called for this alongside saying that we should have a food system strategy at a federal level, is that you need something like a ministry or a minister of food systems and or food and food security, you know, equivalent of what these local governments have done, that they've developed up and allocated a specific role who's across all of the different departments. seeing that at federal level, because otherwise this siloed thinking will only continue and we won't move on. We'll be worried about waste, we'll be worried about production, we'll be worried about other things, but no one's ever going to be looking at it together if you don't have someone that is sitting across it all of it.
That's really interesting. I guess I'd never really thought of creating a separate ministry of food and food systems and food security. How realistic do you think that that is? And or have you seen stuff like from other people that have been maybe lobbying for this for a while? Like, is that something that might actually happen, or do you see that might actually happen?
In terms of the allocation of a person, I'm not sure. But you do have places like Canada that do have a national food policy. So I think it's definitely not impossible. I mean, society is created by us. We're capable of creating, changing it to however we want it to be. So it's not an impossible ask. And you see places like New Zealand that have their wellbeing budget and all these kind of alternatives have been talked about for a long time, but governments are pretty averse to jumping in and trying something that's drastically new. Or they sit and wait until a few people do it, a few governments do it, and then they might also try and give it a go. In a horrible way, as many things are because of the pandemic, it's given us a lot of perspective, and people are generally a lot more aware now about these issues because people on the ground have experienced it. Like, we've experienced bare shelves, yet we've got the government saying to us, don't worry, we're a food secure nation. But you have people on the ground going to their supermarkets or their local grocer and going, oh, what are we eating this week?
And food systems is such a beautiful way of looking at it because it really transpires all aspects of food. Because even at the moment, like, you know, Brisbane, but even maybe more so the Northern Rivers of New South Wales have just, you know, gone through this huge flood period, and they definitely don't have food on the shelves. Like, I know here in Brisbane, we don't have some food on the shelves, and it's, yes, you do hear it's coming, it's fine, we've got stock, but you know, there's nothing. If it's on the shelf, it doesn't matter what's in stock. And because roads are cut off, you know, the NT had that for a little while where there was no food, literally no fresh food on the shelves. And because of the flooding, like, we are a food secure nation, but sometimes our food system isn't working as effectively as it could. I think it's a really important point and something we definitely need to plan, but to have a dedicated person working in that space would just be phenomenal as well. From doing all this work, I guess, what are the next steps now that you have all this data and it's up on the website? Is there anything else planned in the future? Yeah, where are you going to from here?
From the workshop that we held, one of the questions we asked was like, what more can we do with our research findings? And there was a lot of requests from those participants around having really short things like policy briefs that they can use to advocate. And before my time wraps up at the end of June on this project, I'm also really hopeful that I'll be able to wrap up kind of this second entire part of this project, which I mentioned at the start. We were talking about local governments, but also civil society. So really briefly, we were also doing some exploratory scoping around what civil society, not-for-profit groups in Australia are doing. So we went nationally for this one. So again, kind of trying to see who are the players who are out there, who's doing something, and what are they doing? So we ran a survey that was open to any Australian organisation that said that they were doing something in food system governance.
And when you're talking about those organisations, because, I mean, civil society to me is such a foreign term, but I mean, my kind of thought just immediately goes to someone like Food Fairness Illawarra or Healthy Cities Illawarra, where Burble is from, that was on the podcast. Is that kind of who you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So definitely those kind of grassroots initiatives. So yeah, Food Fairness Illawarra being a really local coalition, but also things like the Obesity Policy Coalition. So they kind of operate more at a national level. So they're still, you know, both coalitions. They're both various people that have expertise in certain areas that come together. Obviously here it's a local thing in the Illawarra, and also kind of either state or national bodies for things like community gardens, so Community Gardens Australia or a farmers market. So you've got the Australian Farmers Market Association.
And but they had to have an influence on the governance structures at a local government level?
No, not at a local government level. They had to, you know, activities had to involve food system governance, but it didn't have to be at the local government level. But then we were interested within that if they were involved with local government, because we'd obviously done all this work on local governments. Yeah.
And so have you done, is that survey closed now?
Yeah, so it was open last year. So we ran that, and again, we got 43 responses, which for a nation seems really, really small. But as I said, we don't really have a long history, particularly around food systems thinking, but around food system governance. So there's a lot of organisations that are doing food systems work, but they're not necessarily maybe not engaged in food systems governance. So, you know, we identified and we emailed a lot of organisations. But also, you know, we've got the pandemic. People don't want to respond to surveys when we're talking about food organisations when they might be now engaged in emergency response around the pandemic. So again, these organizations are so under-resourced. They're normally not for profit. They rely on volunteers a lot. And so, you know, if you're listening to this, you're probably already interested in food. So maybe you already are involved in an organization, but if you're not, go and find one that you're interested in helping out. You've probably got expertise in a particular thing, even if it's like a, I guess, more of a little side skill. You might be a researcher, but you might also be great with social comms, and so they might need someone that helps them out with that. And yeah, it's just like a really great way to engage with the community and do something outside of your normal paid work role.
Absolutely. And so once that's all done, that's you mentioned you're finishing in June. Is there anything else that's happening between now and then?
So after we did the survey, kind of similar to the local governments, we were interested in talking to a few of these organisations and giving deeper detail around what they do and how they do it, and again, the barriers and enablers. So we used that list of people that responded to our survey, organisations that responded, and I had that, it was just a delight. I had this amazing experience. I got to talk to 9 organisations about what they were doing. And so for some of them, it was a couple of people, or for some people, it might have only been one person. And they might have set this up, organization up, like it's their baby, and they are so passionate about it and so enlightened and big picture thinking. So at the moment, I'm in the process of going through them and analyzing them to draw out, you know, those common themes around barriers and enablers and another thing.
And then on that, like, you know, you've talked a lot about local government and how much of a role they play, which is obviously really critical, but with these civil society organizations and non-government organizations, how important are they in this space of food system governance? Like, what else do they add on top of like a local government or even like state and federal government? Like, why do we need those organizations to be in this space?
So it's things like food sovereignty and food democracy. So, which is really like at broad strokes terms, is around us as people having control over our food and our food systems. And so this is where civil society is really important in answering your question, that we also need to have the power to shape our food systems. And if we only rely on local government, we don't have that. And we lose valuable aspects of the food system that we need to retain. And I guess we can kind of see that at the moment our food system's quite dysfunctional in the sense that we've got a lot of disease. It's damaging our environment, and civil society really bring those perspectives to the fore. You know, issues around respecting Indigenous knowledges and Indigenous food systems, and obviously those food systems that sustained our country forever. And there's a lot more recognition now of the need to listen to Indigenous elders and community members around those practices, and whether there's, well, not whether, like, you know, how we can help us get our food system and our environment back on track. And that's not something that we have at government level. So we need those civil society organizations that are focused on that space and around continuing healthy and sustainable and equitable, you know, or equitable being like with justice with food system, and calling out when, you know, big business is doing wrong and it's not acting in the interests of small scale producers and those sort of things.
Yeah, definitely. And I think even like as you're talking, I'm thinking of the ability of some of these organizations to have a voice where sometimes governments can't. Like, from having worked in government, you sometimes do feel, you know, you want to speak out and you want to say these things, but because of the space you're in and, you know, you represent the government, you can't speak out at a certain level. And it's those civil society organizations that are grassroots, and they, and even if it's grassroots, it can still be quite a large organization, but they have this kind of more freedom of speech and freedom of thought, and can put those ideas forward and those voices forward in a way that sometimes individuals within government just cannot. I wanted to ask that question because I think sometimes we forget the importance of having this diversity of organizations within a certain space, working from multiple different angles. I guess my final question on this project, Amy, is what have been some of your biggest learnings or even your greatest challenges along the way when you've undertaken this project? And is there anything that, you know, if someone were to do this again, and hopefully they don't have to, but if they did, maybe in a different space, is there anything you'd do differently?
For me, I guess not having had that much experience in local government or any government, definitely the biggest shock or realization of something sinking in was how much local governments work in silos. I don't mean to say in a critical way, like that's just how they've worked for so long. And maybe for other issues, it's fine. You know, if you're providing tennis courts or community facilities, that's fine. But when we're talking about food systems, which are just that, like they are a system, we really need decision makers that are also working and thinking in that way. And for the most part, they're obviously not at the moment, but hopefully they can move in that way so that we're thinking about everything. We're thinking about health, we're thinking about social outcomes, we're thinking about environmental goals. So that we actually have the ability to create a food future that we want for our society and for our planet, so that it's not just the next generation. It's not even my generation, you know, I'm a bit worried, but it's not even the next one. And I get some really beautiful sentiments from Indigenous cultures around the world that they talk about something like the things that you do today need to be for the seventh or eighth generation after you. And at the moment, I don't see that we are operating in that way. We operate in the here and now. And so, I mean, the learning is that we need to change the way that we're thinking, we as a society, but particularly those that obviously have the biggest influence in governance. So, you know, our government decision makers, so that we can have an eighth generation from now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really good thing to pick up on and to advocate for, because and it's hard. It's gonna be a really difficult thing to coordinate that. But you've talked about a few things that might work to try and coordinate that space.
Yeah, just increasing that momentum about thinking of food systems as a system. And, you know, it's great that we've got people that are really dedicated to the concept of systems thinking, and such an asset to probably be able to draw on that expertise, getting that from a conceptual level to an application in food systems. And we can't keep reducing food systems down to nutrition and telling people to eat healthy food. We know that doesn't work. We know that, you know, going, go, don't eat that chocolate bar, eat the apple. That doesn't work. And we also can't rely on kind of greenwashed solutions, say, to food waste, where we've got, you know, food rescue, which as a band-aid solution is, yeah, that's great. It's getting food out of landfill and sending it to people who were otherwise going hungry. But it's just that. It's a bit of a band-aid fix to deeper societal issues. And, yeah, related to that, you know, we've touched on the fact that food systems also involve issues like affordable housing and social connection and culture. And these are all kind of single solutions that are important, but we really need to be doing them in a strategic way.
Yeah, and like, I mean, that just ties into that kind of systems thinking, doesn't it, where we need to identify food systems as a whole, and then we need to identify solutions to maybe the different linkages between different aspects of the food system and act on them in a really coordinated way that acts at that systems level. And it's through many parts that a system is made. So it's through many different, you know, strategies, policies, programs, projects that we will act on the food system and modify it in a way that becomes more beneficial to the outcomes in which we want it to achieve. And then what would you say has been your favorite food experience?
Particularly memories of traveling and food when you're traveling. But yeah, in the middle of 2019, I went to Pakistan with my dad as a birthday present, and we trekked towards K2 base camp. So K2 is the second highest mountain in the world after Everest. And we just found this amazing restaurant in Islamabad with the most delicious curries. And then kind of going from that to eating the food that we had on the trek, which was incredible given that you're a long way from anywhere and at high altitude. Yeah, and learning that I'd go and sit in the cooking tent with the chef that we had on our trek, and he'd show me how to make, you know, parathas and chapatis and stuff. And you just can't beat that.
No, you really can't. That's going to be pretty hard to top. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and telling us all about this wonderful project that you've done, that you've put a huge amount of work in with you and your team, that I think is just such an asset to the food and nutrition space within Australia. And yeah, I'm really excited to see kind of what comes from it. We will put some links in the show notes about where we can find all of that. But yeah, thanks for coming on.
That's all right. Yeah, so much thank you for having me, and I really look forward to the next one after this as well.
So thanks everyone for listening, and remember, we're on Instagram or Twitter if you'd like to get in touch or ask us any questions or even share some of our content with some of your social networks. And if you do get the chance, please leave us a review on whatever podcast app that you're listening on, because this will help us spread the word all about public health nutrition.